You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson in for Rob Ferret. The U.S. Census has had an interesting year. It's seen political battles over the inclusion of a citizenship question, a delay in door-to-door operations, and now a legal fight over how long it can keep gathering responses. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross tried to set September 30th as a deadline, but after a federal judge ruled against that, it became October 5th. And after yet another court decision over the weekend, it currently stands at October 31st. Getting a count of Americans has never been easy, and this isn't the first census we've taken during challenging times. So we're taking a look back at the obstacles the census has faced in the past and how it's dealt with them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how the U.S. Census works now or has worked in the past? Are you wondering how the census has changed over time? Do you worry about the accuracy of this year's census given the pandemic and political battles? Is the census important to you to fill out every 10 years? And have you ever been a census worker? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Margo Anderson is a distinguished professor emerita of history at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. Margo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I don't think it's an understatement to say that this year's census has been interesting for more than one reason, including this shifting deadline of when responses can be taken in person and online. Before we look at the history, how do you feel about the way things have played out this year?
Well, it's like everything else in the United States this year, it's been quite a ride. The census was about to go into the field. April 1st is census day every 10 years. And of course, we all know now that that's exactly when the COVID pandemic hit really hard and the country locked down. So that it meant that a lot of the operational work involving sort of the human element of counting had to be pushed back and is still going on at the moment. The electronic version of the census, which is the new internet option, seems to have worked quite well and went forward in any case, and so did the mail, the older forms of mail and phone. But the in-person work has been really disrupted by the pandemic.
We've talked with you before about the history of if and how citizenship gets measured by the census. Can you remind us briefly of how that aspect, which was kind of one of the first obstacles for this year's census, has played out over time?
Okay. The U.S. Has been interested in the citizenship status of the foreign-born population for a very long time, and so the questions go back into the 19th century. We've never asked the question of native-born Americans because they have birthright citizenship. So what happened in 2018 is that the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, proposed putting it as a question on the census form for everyone. In the context of the kind of very contentious debates about citizenship and immigration in the United States, that drew opposition and legal challenges, which were ultimately resolved in favor of the plaintiffs. So the question did not go on the census. That was essentially resolved by about June or July of 2019.
So the COVID-19 pandemic obviously has delayed in-person operations for a while. And then there have been political wranglings also about moving this time frame when the answers are the responses are submitted and when they are submitted to the White House. Have there been other times in history when a national crisis has coincided with a census and made it difficult to operate?
There have always been, hiccups and glitches and problems. I mean, think of natural disasters, hurricanes or, or the fires on the West Coast and so forth, which we're also experiencing this time. So what is different this year is that this is the first time that the entire nation has been hit by an unplanned event, namely the pandemic. So it's not just a local problem, it's a national one. I've been asked this a lot lately, and Americans have gotten through those hiccups, if you will, and problems with the census in past decades. I've been using those as sort of analogies about how we could do that again this time. Because we do need to use the results of the census to reapportion Congress as the Constitution requires, and then for myriad other uses for the next 10 years.
We're talking right now with Margo Anderson. She's a distinguished professor emerita of history at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. And we are talking about the many obstacles and challenges that the census is having this year. It is interesting, Margo, because the census is used for a lot of things like apportioning federal money, apportioning congressional representation. Mm-hmm. You know, if we go back not even that far ago, let alone the early decades of the census, the population was smaller and transportation and technology wasn't what it is now. Did we have different expectations for what the census could gather back then compared to today?
Well, the goal was always, as in the current language, to count the population once, only once, and in the right place, which is the constitutional requirement. It used to take a lot longer, because transportation was much slower, and frequently Congress would have to extend the deadlines, for example, of getting the results in, and there are even cases where Congress reapportioned itself knowing that they were missing data, or that the data that they had, they thought, and the census officials at the time thought as well, had problems. But they did it anyway because of the importance of this. It's very much like an election. There are winners and losers, and we reallocate every decade, and by and large, we don't cancel elections. We keep we use the results of them, and that has also been, by and large, true of the census. We use it, and we make the best of what we have, and that's a debate that we'll have as a country, pretty much as soon as the in-person counting stops, which should be the end of this month, end of October, and I have a feeling that debate is going to go on into the 2020s for a couple of years.
The census is never going to be able to get a response from every single person in the country. Right. But that said, is there generally a response rate that the census aims for and is considered a valid census if it meets that threshold?
Okay. Well, of course, they strive like we all do for perfection. And actually what they're doing, it is not counting people. They're counting addresses and who's living at that address as of April 1st, the April 1st date. So what their goal is as a counting operation is to account for all those well over 100 million addresses on their list. And try to get up to 99.9% of those addresses, what they call accounted for. Remember that some of those addresses are vacant, right? So they have to, nobody was living in that building in April. You see that, for example, in vacation areas. Northern Wisconsin particularly is a very tricky area to count because of that. And so the goal is to account for the address list and to do it fairly so that we don't create advantage or disadvantage for any particular piece of geography, ethnic group, political constituency, economic area. In other words, it's like an election. We need to have the results to be understood as fair. Mm. We could undercount or overcount the population if we did it uniformly all over the country, and it wouldn't make any difference. It's the differential, like your town got counted better than my town, that's the problem. That could be the problem.
So that's an interesting point, Margo. I hadn't really thought about it this way. Whereas, say, an election is based on the individuals, the census is actually based on the place of residence.
Right. Well, mechanically, in other words, they have to, you know, if you look back, if you remember the postcard or the address, the little thing that you got in the mail in the spring, most of us, there was no name on it. Mm-hmm. It just went to the address. And so the Bureau spends a lot of time and money on our behalf creating what is called a master address file for the entire United States and putting each one of those addresses on a big map. That it's the same map, by the way, that all the, you know, the Amazon and UPS and stuff uses to deliver stuff to all of us. And it's because they don't know who's going to be living there on April 1st. They just have to go to the residents and say, who's there? And get a few answers to questions about characteristics of people. And then say, thank you very much. And we'll see you in 10 years.
We're talking with Margo Anderson, Professor Emerita at UW-Milwaukee and author of The American Census, A Social History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of the U.S. Census? Are you curious about how it's dealt with challenges in the past? Or maybe who it's counted over the years and who's been left out? Are you concerned about the accuracy of this year's census amid COVID-19 and legal fights over its deadline? And if you've ever been a census worker, we'd love to hear your experiences. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the U.S. Census with Margo Anderson. She's a professor emerita at UW-Milwaukee and author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. Margo, it seems like with technology, the internet especially, it would be easier to survey more people and see self-response rates go up. Have we seen evidence of that?
Actually, well, of course, this is the first time that the census has relied heavily on an internet response. There are lots of other surveys that the Census Bureau and the federal government do that use internet responses, but this is the first time we've used it massively for the census. And there were a bit of worries last year and the year before about whether the bandwidth would be enough, whether people could get in and so forth. It seems to have worked pretty well. And that, of course, takes an enormous technical burden off the census, because you realize that if people fill it out on paper, which has been the method for a couple hundred years, you have to transfer the information from the paper to a digital format so that it can be added up. Well, by using the internet, you go straight to a digital format, and that should save a lot of money and time for the next stage of the work, which is the processing. Now, we also know that there's going to be, partially because of the pandemic, that there are going to be a lot of questions about accuracy. Think, for example, of college students who should have been counted at their dorms, for example, on April 1st, but had already left their university addresses and gone home. Where do you count them? So the professionals who are worrying about this are expecting not only a lot of complicated decisions, but a lot of double counting. In other words, people may have filled out the form twice, because they were doing that like in the last week of March, just as the pandemic was really altering where people lived in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that work of what they call post-processing is in front of us still. We don't really know yet how severe it is.
We're talking with historian Margo Anderson right now about the U.S. Census, the obstacles it has faced in the past, and what we're looking at today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Jamie in Lodi is up. Hi, Jamie.
Hello, thank you. I originally was asking about safeguards, what things are put in place for fraud. So, like, if an Illinois person owned a property in northern Wisconsin, what about them putting in fraudulent numbers? But then the other thing I was wondering is, what about having an online database so it's actually updated more frequently? That's the second question that I just kind of came up with. Thank you.
And what do you mean by an online database exactly, Jamie?
Well, obviously, if I move on the next, if I moved in from April to someplace in October, if I moved three times, I lived in three different residencies since it was originally sent out to when it's replied. So, if the population decreases by five people, like, you know, what about having something that's a little bit more up to date more often, so we actually have a real time number of what things are actually at?
Got it. Thanks so much for that, Margo.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the mechanisms that a lot of other countries use. It's a different kind of counting, population counting. It's called a register, a population register, and it is continuous. So Scandinavian countries have used this system for a very long time, where you you know, essentially report where you live, and if you move, you report that, and your record shifts from your old residence to your new residence. So you can do that. The U.S. has never been terribly keen politically on doing that, on having a population register. It's been proposed numerous times, but it's always been sort of seen as cumbersome, and especially because we have a federal system of management. Think of driver's licenses, for example, where if you move from one state to another, you have to get a new driver's license. So it's never happened. Now, a question about somebody filling out the form twice, once in Illinois and once in northern Wisconsin, that's exactly what is yet to happen, and what in terms of the checking on that. The Census Bureau essentially has in its own databases, estimates of, first of all, we know what the population in those areas was 10 years ago. And we also know, you can also see the names and the addresses and the information against itself. So if you find, three, John Smiths with exactly the same information, you're going to have to decide which one is the duplicate.
Thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and Samantha in Whitehall is up. Hi, Samantha.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Rachel, anyway, I was just wondering, how do people in nursing homes and assisted living and also in prisons and jails get counted?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thanks for that, Samantha. And Margo, I'll also add in there, Greg called and wondered about the homeless population, how they are accounted for.
Anybody who's in something like an institutional setting, that's everything from college dorms to prisons to hospitals and nursing homes and so forth, lives in something that is called group quarters. And the Bureau has separate procedures. Basically, they contact the administrators of the institution and they count people. So it's a collaboration between the management of the institution and the Census Bureau. So yes, you're exactly right. That's exactly what they have to do. And you can go on the Census Bureau website and put in group quarters and find out all about how they do that.
Great.
The same thing is true for the homeless, or what they call a service-based enumeration, where they send out, that was done in late September, people to known places. Again, they get the information from local governments that people living not in standard housing would be that night, and they count them there. They count them where they're encountered.
We have just about a minute and a half left, but I want to try to sneak Rafaela in Wausau in. Rafaela, thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I was a census worker this year, and I'm bilingual. I speak Spanish. I found it very challenging when speaking with people of Hispanic origin, majority being from Mexico, to explain to them that they, being Mexican, they were not, that was not their race. And then they had to try to choose from the race category.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that was hard.
Yeah.
They're like, but I soy Mexicano, ¿qué puedo decir? So they're like, so then I had to try to guide them And I didn't want to answer for them. I want to dignify them with them being able to say their themselves.
Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for that, Rafaela.
Yeah. You're raising the kind of question in a very diverse country that people with different linguistic backgrounds always face, which is, what do these questions mean? And they don't quite fit. They do represent an Anglo sort of political tradition, and the word race, raza in Spanish, doesn't quite mean the same thing. And so you're identifying an issue that has, you know, is one of the reasons that they want enumerators like you to be on the ground trying to help people respond.
Thank you so much for that call. And Margo, just about 10 seconds left. If people have not yet filled out the census, can they go to the census website?
Yes, they can. They can go to census.gov, and you'll be able to find a link to how to respond.
Great. Thanks so much, Margo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Margo Anderson is a professor emerita of history at UW-Milwaukee and author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. We talked with her about how the U.S. Census has dealt with challenges in the past and how it's functioning in 2020. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to a political scientist about the history of presidential illnesses in light of President Trump's recent COVID-19 diagnosis. All that and more coming up on Central Time tomorrow at this time.